Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live for a very special Friday show. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we're in Phoenix, Arizona at the Convention Center in Phoenix, where tomorrow EWTN will have their big giant family conference, and I heard maybe 5,000 people to that conference, so that should be extraordinary. And today we're here with some of the most, well, no, pretty much all of the most important people in Catholic radio in the United States are here. The people who have purchased the stations, have organized the volunteers, have kept them going in many cases for decades in order to bring Catholic radio to people all around the United States. So it's an extraordinary group of people. And we also get to hang out with some of the hosts from EWTN. So this hour, Dr. David Anders will be our guest, and we'll have an open forum. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Next hour, Jerry and Debbie from Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network will be here with us, and your calls will be welcome then as well. Dr. David Anders, you probably know him from a very well-named show that is called The Communion with Dr. David Anders. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You're working hard today. Second time you could...
Works 2 whole hours today. It's about to break my back.
In radio, man, that is a full day of work. It's really fun to be here with all the people who are the founders and the caretakers of these Catholic radio stations.
I have a blast every time I come into one of these things, and I love to go meet affiliates and the people that run them, and it's a tremendous labor of love. I mean, you know, I remember I met Tony Holman, who started Covenant Network in St. Yeah. Louis, and I said, how'd you get into this business? And he said, well, I started going to Eucharistic Adoration.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah.
I mean, that's not your typical, you know, like, rags to riches media story. It starts in Eucharistic Adoration and listening to the Catholic talks on tapes and wanting to bring this treasure to the world. And everybody's story is like that. It's not a professional aspiration they had from childhood. Nobody grows up saying, I want to work in Catholic radio.
Right.
But they meet the Lord, and they get captivated by the idea of sharing what's transformed their lives, and it's this labor of love. And you find people from all walks of life, people that were engineers or lawyers or carpenters or whatever.
Right.
And they find themselves in this work of Catholic radio, and we all have this love of the gospel and love of sharing it in common. My story is the same way. I had absolutely no intention of getting into Catholic radio. I thought I was going to be a Protestant seminary professor.
Yeah.
And that's what I trained for. And then, lo and behold, the Lord had a completely different use for that skill set.
It's amazing. And you will hear the stories of faith are really extraordinary. I almost wish we could broadcast the whole conference because, you know, somebody will get up to ask a question. And even in the course of asking the question, you realize this person has, just in the description of where they're coming from, completely stepped out in faith, risked their entire, you know, fortune and retirement so that they could start a Catholic radio station. And it's just a magnificent group of people.
It is. And I've been around the country and seen different stations, I've walked into studios and I felt like, well, this is a very sophisticated studio. This could be some secular news outlet.
Yeah.
Then I've also been in small towns.
Yeah.
And I said, well, where's the station? Then I walked to the, you know, to the broom closet of the parish, you know, or the rectory.
Yeah.
Somebody opens a broom closet or a linen closet, and you see a stack of equipment. They go,
right.
There's the radio station.
Yep, that's exactly right. We had a very nice evening last night. Thanks for joining us. We had the Catholic Answers sponsor get together, mostly to say thank you that all these folks are willing to carry our program on state. We're on almost 400 stations around the country now, I guess, and so we got to say thank you. But you were gracious enough to come and visit with everybody.
Oh, well, you were gracious enough to feed us.
Yeah, well, that's right. They were awfully good meatballs that they had at that last night. I checked in with the Italians, as a matter of fact, like my boss John Versillo over there and Ray Garendi, and said, "Is this?" And they were all the Italians
they gave
like,
you the
"This
seal
is
approval.
Real Italian food.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
This is the good stuff."
Oh, good.
888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, the number. Dr. David Anders is our guest, and I think we'll go right to the phones because we got calls.
Oh, fantastic.
All right.
What we got to say.
Let's start with Myron in Fulton, New York, listening on 88.7 FM. Myron, go ahead with your question for Dr. Anders.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but I'm really grateful for you taking my call. The thing I'm wondering about is why Biden and all the other pro-abortion, pro-LGBTQ, SMI Catholics are not excommunicated. You know, Beckett was murdered for a lot less than that, and he excommunicated this knight for killing a priest. And it just seems totally disproportionate now, looking at Washington and all their, you know, Catholic politicians. It's just like an outrage. I can't think of the word, but somebody...
Why are they... So the question is... I'm sorry, Myron. I think I stepped on you. There's a little bit of a delay, and I apologize for that. But you're asking Dr. Anders, why aren't these people excommunicated, who are clearly neglecting Catholic teaching and basic morality and supporting things like abortion? Is that's the question, Myron?
Exactly. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I think I can take a stab at that, and I appreciate it. So you correctly pointed out that there was a period in the church's history where the bishops made much more avid use of the discipline of excommunication. And in fact, you could argue that maybe sometimes their use of the discipline was even a bit on the profligate side, because people could get excommunicated for all kinds of things, even infractions that we would consider quite trivial today. And sometimes the accusation could have been made legitimately against the bishops that they misused church discipline for their own political self-aggrandizement or in pursuit of their own, economic or political aims. And as you know, the papacy at times in the Middle Ages was heavily involved in secular politics. In fact, it was a player in secular politics. The Pope ruled over the papal states, which is significant portions of what is today Italy, and would sometimes wield his ecclesiastical might to advance his political ambitions. So that sort of soured, as you can well imagine, the Christian populace on the use of excommunication. It kind of cheapened it in the popular imagination, as they could reasonably conclude, and it sort of lost its spiritual force. And I think that many bishops today would take the position that, you know, the ultimate goal of ecclesiastical discipline is the health of the body of Christ. That's the reason we exercise church discipline, both for the soul of someone who is violating church teaching in some way, maybe scandalously, as well as for the preservation of the people of God who are not doing that, that they wouldn't be scandalized and that the Eucharistic community not be scandalized. So if that's the goal, if the goal is the ultimate health of the church body and the soul in question, then you have to make a prudential decision about what is the best way to bring about that outcome. And so I am not a bishop, thanks be to God. And I don't have to make a decision about whether or not to excommunicate some soul in my jurisdiction. But I can perform the thought experiment and imagine what would it be like to be a bishop and have to make that judgment call. And what is the outcome that I would anticipate if I do this? You know, would I, in fact, bring, you know, a particular soul to repentance? I mean, that's the ultimate goal. Would I bring this person to repentance? And would I succeed in inoculating or protecting the faithful against scandal? Would those be the outcome? And I could make the case. Now, my answer is neither pro nor con. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm not taking a position, but I'm trying to perform a hypothetical exercise in which I could say, I could certainly see a position where, in our given cultural and political environment, if a bishop made use of the discipline of excommunication for a moral issue that's deeply partisan and politicized, that the way that would go down, the way the populace would understand that, the way that would be conveyed in the media, would be in entirely partisan and political terms.
Right.
And the moral question would get completely lost. I clearly think much of the secular media would have an agenda to represent it that way. And so the result would be you would probably strengthen the backbone of people perceived as your political supporters and partisans, and you would embitter all of the people whose hearts you were trying to reach. And so a person, I could imagine, I'm not defending or attacking this position, I'm just trying to hypothetically think it through, come to the conclusion that the discipline of excommunication may not be the most prudent way for me to address that problem. Okay, so that's one reason why a Catholic bishop might refrain from exercising the discipline of excommunication over a Catholic politician, right? Here's another reason. Maybe the bishop doesn't believe the teaching of the church. Maybe the bishop himself is a political partisan. Maybe the bishop favors the position that some secular politician takes that's at odds with the Catholic faith and plays lip service to the church because really his loyalties lie elsewhere, right? Maybe the bishop is orthodox and faithful and cowardly. I mean, like, there are so many reasons, some of them virtuous, some of them maybe reprehensible, that a bishop might do or fail to do something. Now, here's the good thing about my position and your position as Catholic laypeople. Fortunately, we don't have to judge bishops. That's Jesus's job. Christ is the one that's going to judge the bishop. You know, St. Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he says, I don't care if you guys judge me. Right. I don't judge myself. Christ is my judge. So every bishop will have to give an account of his episcopacy. He'll have to answer to the Lord for the decisions, disciplinary and otherwise, that he makes. The Lord knows his heart, his intention, and ultimately, you know, St. Paul says the proof of every man's work will be tested by fire, and some will escape. And he's talking here about apostles who do a bad job. Some will escape, but as through the flames.
Right.
And others won't. So ultimately, that'll be the Lord's judgment as to whether or not these were the prudent decisions or otherwise. Fortunately, I don't have to make that judgment.
Myron, thanks very, very much for the question. I don't really see why we have Twitter if we're not going to judge bishops then. I mean, why even bother having Twitter?
Well, I canceled all my social media accounts a while back.
And now you're back to being sane? They drive you crazy so fast. Myron, again, thanks for the call.
I had the privilege of finishing all of my higher education before the invention of the Internet.
Yeah.
It really came online. The Internet kind of got cranking in 1995. I took my PhD in 2002, but, you know, the World Wide Web and all the video stuff didn't really start till after that. You know, my first smartphone ever. And I promise you, I could feel the IQ points bleeding out of my brain.
You can, yeah. I know. I actually got to the point where I was having trouble reading books. Which I had never, since I was 12, had trouble reading books. And I was kind of, my mind was tiring. And I realized it's because I'm looking at all these little short blips and it's not doing me any good.
Well, you know, the revenue model is designed to generate distraction, and they get paid for your click-throughs, not for your sustained attention.
Yeah.
So they're teaching you distraction, which is the opposite of recollection, which is the precondition for contemplation.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you're going to get paid on my attention span, you're never going to make money. So.
Right. Well, they get paid for your inattention.
That's exactly
that's
right. And that's why
for.
I was making them too much money. We got to take a quick break. Lots more questions. Some from our callers, some from in the room, probably. We're at the National Radio Conference being held by the folks from EWTN. We'll be right back with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Well, Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you with us here on a Friday afternoon, maybe Friday evening where you are, maybe even Saturday morning if you're listening on the other side of the dateline. Wherever you are, we're grateful you spend the time with us. And we're also filled with a special gratitude right now. And I'm sure John Brasillo sitting here, who's the head of Catholic Answers Studios, and the other Catholic Answers guys who came over. What a magnificent opportunity to meet some of the best people in the world when you come to the Catholic Radio Conference here with EWTN. Among those, Adam from the Covenant Radio Network. Did I say it correctly, Covenant Radio Network?
That you did.
All right, Adam, you got a question for
Dr. Anderson. You know, at Covenant Network, a lot of what I focus on is that we don't have to understand to be holy, but we're grateful for Catholic Answers because you guys help us understand. And we've been talking a lot about parenting. So we lost a baby.
During the pregnancy,
it was years ago. God worked through it. We trust in his merciful providence.
Praise God.
But I've never heard an answer that I've been able to pass on to someone else of what happens to that soul, you know, because the child wasn't able to receive the sacrament of baptism, but we also trust in the merciful love of God. So what do we know? What do we hope for?
Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So the church actually doesn't have a dogmatic teaching revealed, you know, something given to us by divine revelation that specifically answers the question. And so we are left to theological speculation from what we can infer from principles, you know, from theology. Now, as you're well aware, in the Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas reasoned like this. Baptism is necessary for salvation. Jesus says so. Church teaches so. But it's necessary in virtue of the reality and inevitability of sin, of actual sin in the human soul. Infants don't have actual sin. They have original sin, which is only sin analogously. It's not personal culpability. It's not personal guilt. In fact, God is just. God would never condemn to hell a soul that didn't have any personal guilt. And so he speculates, the beatific vision is not owed to us, but hell is not deserved by an innocent soul. And so there must be an intermediate state of purely natural happiness. Think eternity at a Caribbean hotel and golf resort, you know, that he speculated, you know, the gone down in history is, or
dinner included, or
dinner included. Well, okay, that's what floats your, if that's what floats your boat,
okay,
that's what floats your boat, you know? And so that seemed, it had the force of St. Thomas's personality behind it. And he's an eminent figure in Catholic thinking, and it was logical. And so that held sway for a long time. It was an extremely common opinion. In more recent theological thinking, I think there's a greater appreciation for something we've always known but hadn't thought about as clearly, that God can and does extend grace to souls in extra-sacramental and extraordinary ways known only to himself, right? And so there's intimations of this in sacred scripture. Of course, all the Old Testament saints were in possession of sanctifying grace. They were graced without the benefit of the Christian sacraments. And that included people outside the household of faith, outside of Israel. So the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we learn about those like Enoch who walked with God and God took him. Right? Definitely didn't have the covenant of Abraham or the new covenant in Christ. Righteous Job is not an Israelite. And you could go down the list and find these characters. So there's evidence from Scripture itself, or you know, the Gentiles who have the law written on their heart and so forth. That combined with an understanding of the universal will of God to salvation has led modern theologians, like Pope Benedict especially, to conclude that it is also extremely reasonable to conclude, to presume upon God's mercy in this instance, without actually teaching that as a dogma of the faith. And so that's, you know, it is unthinkable to me that anything other than glory would be the position of these children. Can I teach that as a dogmatic fact? No, but I can teach it as a very reasonable theological opinion that's held by the current pontiff and previous pontiffs.
Adam, thank you very, very much. And thank you for everything you do at the Covenant Radio Network, where I know you are also the official joke writer, as you told me at lunch. And I can tell you, there's soon going to be an opening for official joke writer if Adam's the joke writer at Covenant Catholic Radio. Steve in Napomo, California. We're always happy when you call. Steve's watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Steve, with your question for Dr. David Anders.
Thank you, Si, and Dr. David. I just would like some clarity on the Synod on Synodality's webpage with their drawing. of what they consider the what the Catholic Church should be. Have you seen that?
I have read about it, so I know what was contained in the drawing. I have not seen the image, but I have read a description of it, so I do know what we're talking about. Yeah, thank you. So here's my take on it. I have read the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops' summary of the synodal documents from the various dioceses in the United States. I've read some of the local synod documents, and I work for my own diocese, so I'm deeply familiar with the synod process in my own diocese and the reports that came out of our own investigations. And the one common thread that you find really across the entire country, I haven't read any of the synod documents from other countries in the world, but I can speak to the American one, is that in one form or another, all of the faithful desire to have deeper connections to their parishes, to one another, to their priests and religious. And the most common complaint one hears is not about lack of doctrinal formation or access to the sacraments. It is a sense of belonging, friendship, and accompaniment with other members of the people of God. And just anecdotally, as someone who works in Catholic radio, who was a convert to the Catholic Church myself, one of the common complaints I hear from converts who come into the Catholic Church, and they've come from religious communities where they had tight networks and a lot of friends and a sense of solidarity and commonality and family, is they step into many Catholic parishes and nobody says hello, nobody greets them, and they may go years without the priest ever even knowing their name. And that's so profoundly alienating, and it's a wound, and it's really a problem in Catholic formation. It's something that we need to address, and this is what the synod documents have more or less produced. Now, you can be in any number of sort of demographic groups and have this experience of alienation. I mean, I am a married heterosexual white male from the South, and I have experienced feeling alienated in the Catholic parish. I mean, that's just been my experience. I'm sure it's been most people's at some point in time. But that can be compounded even more if you are in an irregular situation. So something that was near and dear to the heart of Pope John Paul II, for example, was how can the church have a pastoral outreach to, say, divorced and civilly remarried couples that are not invalid marriages. And so when he wrote a Familiaris Consortio, which was the synodal exhortation on ministry to families, he had special instructions on how can the church have a pastoral outreach to people that they might not administer the sacraments to, but we can't just cast aside like they don't matter. And that is a neuralgic point, continues to be a neuralgic point in Catholic ministry. Now, because of the political environment, because of the social environment, because of because of secular media and its influences, the issue of LGBTQ plus people in civil society has risen to prominence and consciousness in a way that it has never had before, probably in the history of the world. And so naturally, this is going to be reflected in the language that the church uses. And it has definitely come across in some of the synodal documents. So when you read the reports of the lay faithful, all of them testify to at least some people who for whom this is a very live issue. How does the church do pastoral ministry to people who dissent from church's teaching or who live lifestyles that the church doesn't approve? So, and I think that's a legitimate question, right? What is the best pastoral approach to handling these people who are marginalized for one reason or another in the church's ministry? And so that's going to continue to be a live issue, both within the synodal discussion and within the larger pastoral framework of modern Catholicism. Now, are there people in the church hierarchy who have a specific ideological agenda about how to answer that question? Of course there are, both on the left and on the right. Right?
Yes.
But of course there are. Okay?
Of course, yes.
Now, I don't know who produced these drawings and images on the Synod webpage. I have no idea deeply what their particular point of reference is. But one could reasonably infer that the people that were in charge of the webpage have an opinion, let us say, about the right way to handle that issue. And they have expressed that, artistically. So, does the Synod on Synodality webpage amount to an official magisterial pronouncement on ministry to people who dissent from Catholic teaching on the male-only priesthood or on LGBTQ plus Catholics? I think not.
Yeah.
I think not. You know, and that's just how we have to look at it. Like in any given time in Catholic ministry, you're going to have people that take positions that are at odds with the Holy See or at odds with the tradition, or at least at, you know, significant variance to the census fidelium or what have you. And that's always been the case. And even the popes themselves have, through history, made monumentally imprudent decisions, both politically, theologically, and otherwise. And the charism of infallibility and the tradition of the church just functions within that human element and always has.
Steve, I know that you have been telling us for a while that you're considering moving into the Catholic Church. I do hope that that answer was helpful to you. I know that some of these things can feel quite scandalizing, and that's the nature of the Catholic faith, made up of a lot of human beings, some of which are doing their very best. Not everyone.
I think our first pope did some scandalizing, didn't he?
I remember he had one really bad night on a Friday night. Thursday night.
he had a really bad night on a Thursday night, and then he followed it up. You know, he took a trip to Antioch, and he offended half the people there, too.
Oh, that's right. I had forgotten about it. Yeah, it had to be corrected by St. Paul.
St. Paul.
888-318-7884 is the number here. Dr. David Anders, who you hear each day on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network with Call to Communion with Dr. Anders, is our guest. Your call's welcome. We'll take a very quick break and be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret. We've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Friday show. Second hour, Jerry and Debbie will be here from Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Each day, where I am, it's at 1 in the afternoon. We get to hear, and where you are, I don't know what time it is. We get to hear Dr. David Anders and Tom Price and sometimes Jack, right?
Sometimes Jack.
Yeah. And they take questions, and I have to say to you, and I've told Dr. Anders this before myself, it's one of the best hours in radio of any kind. It's one of the best hours in radio. I think there's probably so many people who listen to Call to Communion who may not, in fact, be Catholic. I know that's probably the case because some of them call or send a question in. And I think it's because what they're hearing is the honest to goodness voice of the Catholic Church, a voice of reason and a voice of charity. And I hope you will, if you haven't had a chance to sample that program, that you will. The number here is 888-318-7884. So maybe you've called Call to Communion and they never let you on, and there's because the lines are always jammed. Well, we probably got a couple lines open right now for you. 888-318-7884. Randy in Great Falls, Montana is next, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Randy, go ahead with your question for Dr. David Anders.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question revolves around Vatican II and some of the perceived suppression of, Latin for lack of a better term. So I've read the Sacrosanctum Concilium, and I've seen that it specifically states that the language of Latin is supposed to be retained in the Latin Rite, and I assume that means in the Novus Ordo. However, the parish that I attend, there is currently during ordinary times, there's no Latin, not even any Greek, throughout the Mass on Sunday. And I realize that there's a certain dynamic that's going on within church leadership with regards to the suppression of the traditional Latin Mass, or at least the perceived suppression. I would like Dr. Anders, just like your opinion on situations like mine where the parish is not, in my perception, following the documents that Vatican II has outlined. What, if any, are there any steps to take for someone in the laity to try to address that situation?
Yeah, sure. So let's talk about the status of Sacrosanctum Concilium as church teaching, all right, and the extent to which that's binding on the way we celebrate the liturgy. So all the documents of the Second Vatican Council are documents of the ordinary magisterium of the church. They are not the extraordinary magisterium of the church. They're not teaching dogmatic facts to which one has to assent with divine and supernatural faith. They are, like all actions of the ordinary magisterium, they are teaching documents that are articulating the faith and trying to make sense of it, explain it to the modern world, and set it within a context. And the magisterium doesn't stop the minute the ink dries on the paper. I mean, the same magisterium that produced the text continues to live them and interpret them dynamically, responsively, and in real time. So the way to think about the relationship of the magisterium to the liturgy is we have this tremendous patrimony of Catholic tradition that informs our understanding of the faith. I mean, I myself, as a media person, I'm constantly quoting Sacrosanctum Concilium to make theological points about the meaning of the liturgy and its significance to our lives. But when it comes to the rubrics of the Mass and the laws that govern the Mass, and the particular bishop's decisions about how the liturgy will be celebrated in his diocese, these are not dictated to us, you know, by a paper pope, but by a living pope and living bishops. And it is completely within their jurisdiction to make these kinds of judgment calls about what they think is prudent for the celebration of the liturgy contemporaneously. So that's, you know, the way you're viewing Sacrosanctum Concilium is as if it were sacred scripture and something that was inspired and every word of it was perennially significant in a kind of ultimate way is just not the way we relate to magisterial texts and never have. You know, when it comes to the question of, let's talk about Latin and why that might convert, one of the things that I appreciated about Catholic liturgy, and particularly when I did encounter Latin in the Mass, is it gave me a sense of being connected to something ancient. And, you know, the reason that Latin is widely used throughout the Latin Rite of the Church, during the Western Rite of the Church, and this is somewhat different. When you look at Eastern Christianity, it was much more common to have vernacular liturgies. Slavonic. You could have Old Slavonic. You know, you could have Greek.
If you were waiting for me to help you with Old Slavonic, it wasn't ever going to come to me.
Okay, you could have Syro-Malabar. You know, you could have Coptic. You have all these different language families as the church spread throughout the world. Why did the Western Church, why didn't we have, say, a Latin rite in Rome and, you know, a Gothic rite and a Celtic rite? Well, actually, we did. For a little while, we had a Celtic rite. But there was because the West was all under the Patriarchal See of Rome, and the Pope is the Patriarch of the West, there was this deep awareness that people of God wanted to be in union with the See of Peter.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like something that the Pope came and said, you know, thou shalt celebrate everything in Latin. It developed organically as the people of God wanted to celebrate with the Holy Father in the language of the Holy See. So that's the reason Latin came to predominate in the West. And as a Western Latin Rite Catholic, I've always been appreciative of my ability to worship in that liturgical language and to feel that deep connection to history carrying me back to the ancient popes in the ancient days. Right? But remember, what's primary here is precisely, it's not just primitivism. It's not just the note of being connected to antiquity. You know, I'm not a Catholic because I'm connected to antiquity. I'm a Catholic because I'm in communion with the Pope. And the Pope's not dead. He's very much alive. The Pope is a living magisterium. The Pope is a living vicar of Christ in Rome today, with whom all the bishops of the world are in union. Now, because of historical accident, I would argue, because of historical accident, there has emerged in the very modern world a dynamic where the use of the Latin language for some people, not for everybody, but for some people, has become a kind of theological shibboleth signaling their opposition to the Pope. And this is clearly what Pope Francis has identified. If you read the letter accompanying his motu proprio on Traditionis Custodis, he singles out these individuals and says there are those for whom the Latin Mass and the Latin language have become a sign or a symbol of opposition to the magisterium.
Yep.
And I have heard traditionalists, oh, that's not true. I have heard from the mouths of traditionalists that yes. They use Latin in order to signal their opposition to the Pope. So if the rationale for the use of Latin is to connect one to the church's patrimony with the See of Peter, then the same Latin language should not be used as a sign of contradiction to the See of Peter. And so, you know, that's kind of where we stand. So this is it's a shame. I'd say it really is a historical accident. There are sociological forces at work that nobody could have foreseen that brought this situation about. But for the time being, given that that dynamic exists, unfortunately, the use of Latin in liturgy has become a kind of political lightning rod that does tend to undermine the fundamental reason for the liturgy, or one of the fundamental reasons, which is to express the unity of the church.
Randy, thanks very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Lots of folks on the line. Dr. David Anders, our guest, and we can go to Jerry now in Parma, Ohio, listening on 1260 AM The Rock. And Bernadette Boguski, who runs 1260 AM The Rock, is all over this conference. We've gotten to see her quite a bit. She's an awful, awful good person. We're glad to talk with you, Jerry. I don't know if you know Bernadette, but go ahead with your question for Dr. David Anders.
I do know her, but not really a question, but an observation. Dr. Anders was talking about the sense of family in a parish and, you know, that type of relationship amongst the parish. And my observation is there's nothing that makes a Catholic parish stand out anymore. When I was growing up, the whole second or third grade class went to First Communion together. I mean, the church was full of you know, white veils for the girls and blue suits for the boys. Confirmation was the same way. Everybody went to confirmation. We had holy days of obligation. It didn't matter if it wasn't on a Sunday, if it was on a Wednesday, you went to church. The schools were closed. You know, it's that kind of thing, I think, that the church made a major mistake in moving, you know, holy days to a Saturday or a Sunday, or if it falls on a Monday, you don't have to go. I mean, there's nothing out there anymore that really identifies Eucharistic congresses, 40 hours observation. You know, I can remember 2 o'clock in the morning, kneeling on a kneeler before the monstrance, because you always had to have servers there. We don't do that anymore. We don't do anything. I don't think we do anything that sets the Catholic individual or the Catholic parish apart from from anything else. There's a school here in Cleveland that usually at the beginning of the school year, all the gentlemen get dressed up in, you know, blue blazers, and they march down across a bridge down to the cathedral. You know, that kind of stuff makes a statement, and you don't really see that anymore. That's just kind of the way I look at it.
Thanks, Jerry.
That's
the
problem with the church.
Dr. Anders.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So there's a similar dynamic that I'd like to talk about for a little while and take us back in history a bit in Catholic America. So as you know, there was a huge influx of Catholic immigration to this country in the late 19th, early 20th century, especially from Italy, Ireland, Lithuania, Poland, Czechoslovakia, all these traditionally Catholic countries. And when they flowed into the United States, they tended to congregate in urban enclaves. And so they would congregate in Italian neighborhoods and Irish neighborhoods and Lithuanian neighborhoods and so forth. And they would go to church with their neighbors who lived in their parish, and their parish was very much their geographical parish, so the neighborhood parish would be the center of the neighborhood. And also this was a time when families tended to have a lot more children, and so you had big families, you had lots of brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts, and inevitably, you know, a significant percentage of those would go into religious life or the priesthood. And so everybody had, you know, an uncle, Father Bob, and a sister, you know, aunt, Janelle or whatever it might be. And so it wasn't necessary for parishes to make extraordinary efforts in order to go out of the way to build community, because the community was what built the parish. It's sort of the dynamic went the other direction, right? Now, at the same time that this dynamic of Catholic immigration to the United States was going on, those very same Catholics were very, very, very much being opposed by a nativist element in white Anglo-Saxon Protestant America who controlled the reins of power and economics. And they made no bones about opposing Catholic immigration from these countries. And there was a kind of scare that Catholics were going to come take over the country. And, you know, politically, they were going to be subservient to the Pope and America would lose its democracy and on and on and on. It was a bunch of really sort of hysterical and apocalyptic language and sometimes eventuated in violence. So there would be pogroms even against Catholics and assassinations. I mean, Father James Coyle in my own home diocese of Birmingham, Alabama, was assassinated. He was shot dead on the steps of the rectory in Birmingham in, what was it, 1917, I think, 1918, something like that, for the crime basically of being a Catholic priest. And he exacerbated it by performing an interracial marriage between a Hispanic man and a white woman. And that was just, you know, the Ku Klux Klan couldn't have that in 1918, so off he went. You know, that was the environment for Catholics. And so that further tended to reinforce the sense of solidarity as folks drew closer together in defense against an antagonistic outside world. And so that was the environment. Now, what changed was the war years. 1940s, America entered the war. And Catholics got drafted, and when they came home from the war, they got the GI Bill. And so the grandchildren of those immigrants began to go to college. They began to study law and engineering and medicine. They became entrepreneurs, and their economic fortunes rose significantly in society. And as their economic fortunes rose, there was a tremendous enthusiasm among those third-generation Catholics to finally be accepted, to have legitimacy as Americans. And as you recall, John Kennedy ran for president, the first Catholic president in United States history, on the platform of, I will keep my Catholicism private.
Yep.
Right? Now, that was bad theology, but good politics. And honestly, the Catholics wanted to hear that message as bad as the Protestant ministers in Houston wanted to hear it. The Catholics wanted permission to go private, to go dark with their Catholicism in the public sphere. Now, something interesting was happening in Protestant land. While Catholics were moving culturally into prominence, but religiously into privacy, something else was happening in the Protestant world. The fundamentalist-modernist controversy was absolutely just rocking the Protestant denominations. And the winners in the denominations were the modernists. The liberal faction was taking over the major seminaries and the major mainline Protestant denominations, your Episcopalians, your Presbyterians, your American Baptists, your, you know, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. These denominations and their predecessors were being basically assimilated by the modernist faction, and they were kicking fundamentalists out of their organizations. thinking that fundamentalism would wither and die on the vine, deprived of the money and resources and architecture. Well, the fundamentalists proved much more resilient than their modernist overlords, and they went out and founded their own denominations. And moreover, they moved into the suburbs, and they decided to start building institutions for the purpose of proselytizing in the suburbs. And they also started building radio networks and missionary outreaches and Sunday schools and summer camps and all kinds of social organizations that were really in Campus Crusade for Christ, aimed at meeting the middle class, you know, the very same people that had kicked them out, and reaching them with their fundamentalist message. Now, guess who was moving out of the cities, out of the urban enclaves, out of the Italian neighborhoods, out of the Presbyterian neighborhoods, out of the Lutheran, out of the Lithuanians, the Italians, the Irish neighborhoods? It was the Catholics who were going dark and private with their religion, and they were stepping right into a suburban environment where the fundamentalists were there waiting for them with open arms to missionize them, proselytize them, and draw them into their sort of Sunday school, you know, culture. And the Catholic Church left many of its parishes downtown. They left them in these urban centers, but the sense of community that was built around them began to dissipate for reasons that were entirely demographic. And it has taken the Catholic Church literally a solid generation or two to wake up to the dynamic, because we never had to intentionally build community in our parishes. And things like you were talking about, like the Eucharistic congresses and the processions and the Holy Hours and the Holy Name Society, all these things were natural outgrowths of the culture that was built in and around the parishes. And that culture gradually began to be eked away. And now in 2020, Catholic pastoral thinking has come around to the realization that we've got to address this problem. We have to intentionally build community. We have to start doing these Catholic things again. But in the meanwhile, we've lost a tremendous number of people from the Catholic Church, not for theology, not for sacraments, moral thinking, but for simply demographic reasons that have to do with economics and neighborhood distribution.
Jerry, I'm so grateful for your observations and starting that conversation with Dr. David Anders. That's why I say the hour of Call to Communion is one of the best hours on radio anywhere in the world. You're just not going to find much better than that. That was a magnificent discursus on how we got to where we are. And if you haven't checked it out, I hope you will check out Call to Communion. And we'll take a very quick break and be right back with more with Dr. David Anders on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Dr. David Anders, our guest, and we're having a lot of fun here at the radio conference in Phoenix, the national radio conference, Catholic radio station at EWTN's invitation. Do we have anybody that would like to ask Dr. Anders a question right here in the room?
We have a question for you.
This is Bear.
Bear Wozniak and my wife, Cindy.
Oh yeah, we enjoy your weekend show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Now that I swallowed a macadamia nut, Hawaiian macadamia nut.
That's almost a cliche there.
I know. So more and more we're seeing lawlessness in the streets. You know, we see people acting out, for example, in Waikiki, some young men riding by on their little scooters and they're using the F word really loud. And I get up and I stop them. And I say, excuse me, there's a lady present. You know, you're acting like boys. It takes a man to be a gentleman, you know. And sometimes we have, they're not really homeless. They're more like a criminal element. Sometimes I confront them. But I try to do it usually not too confrontational. Sometimes it requires it. But like, it's kind of like, how do you do that? How do you draw the line? Now when there's a dangerous situation, my wife says, call the police. And they're two blocks down from where we are in Waikiki. But we have more and more of this, in this lawlessness coming into our communities. Should a man, how should a man respond to that? Should he respond at all? That's what we were talking about just before we came over.
You know, that's a magnificent question, and I don't know that I have a definitive answer to this question. You know, I'm just a guy that reads theology books, you know. But but in reading theology books, I'm reminded of the teaching of St. Thomas Aquinas on the virtue of prudence, right? And prudence is the virtue of being able to make good moral decisions concretely in the moment. And to have that prudence requires a whole host of subordinate virtues. Like I need to be circumspect. I need to be able to consider a host of alternatives. I need to be able to take counsel. I need to be able to listen to the counsel of other prudent people. And so I think that in any given time, any given moment, you know, the fundamentals of morality don't change. Human dignity doesn't change. But what counts as a prudent option can change significantly in different cultural situations. I mean, so for example, it might be prudent in some circumstances to stand up and challenge an unjust government, but maybe not a tyranny where you're going to get your head chopped off for it immediately. You know, I mean, like you have to make these kinds of, and this is like the way the church interacted with communist governments in behind the Iron Curtain. Like they made a lot of political calculations. They would make concessions that sort of graded the bishops of the Catholic Church, but they knew they were necessary in order to get the sacraments to the people. I mean, that's just kind of an example of how does prudence actually operate. Now, I don't know Waikiki. I don't know the culture in Hawaii. You know it far better than I do. And so if I were going to go to Hawaii and I were going to talk about, okay, how do I conduct myself, I would ask you, because I'm trying to be a prudent person, I would discern you have more firsthand knowledge. But I wouldn't ask only you. I would ask, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different people. I'd ask your wife. I'd ask folks that I knew to be virtuous, to be moral, but I'd want to get different perspectives, and then I'd try to come to a prudent decision about, can I actually correct this? Is there something I can actually do? Or is in the interest of the safety of my wife and family, do I just need to, you know, turn around and walk away? There is a principle in Catholic moral theology. You know, we have a work of mercy called admonishing the sinner. And so the question has been raised, well, does that mean I just admonish every sinner I ever meet? Do I just run around doing nothing but admonishing sinners all day long? And what Catholic moral theologians tell us is, no, actually there are three conditions for admonishing the sinner. The first one is it's got to be something grave, right? The second one is that the person I'm admonishing is likely to listen. Likely to listen. Otherwise, I may risk just inflaming them and they double down on their intransigence, right? And the third one is, am I the best person to make this admonition? And so there could very well be a situation where you and I, Bear, are walking down the same street in Waikiki, and we see something a little off color, and you conclude, this is serious, they'll listen to me, and I'm the best person to do this. And I may, in the very same situation, prudently conclude, I'm not from around here, you know. I'm a lot skinnier and wimpier looking than Bear is, and they're not going to listen to me. I'm not the best person to make the admonition. And so we could come to different conclusions and both be right in the very same context.
So there's a balance, as we're talking about. When there's a situation that may be dangerous, Cindy's asked me to call the police now. And I'd want to protect her and respecting her. Then I call 911 while I'm walking along so they can follow me. The cops can eventually find me, so I can tell them, here's the criminal, here's what this person is doing.
Well, that sounds like a
but
prudent
I don't
choice.
Confront them.
That sounds like a prudent choice.
When I had my hip surgery, I was using a walker chasing.
Is it criminals with a walker?
And he had a bad leg, so it was the slowest foot chase in history.
Now that's hysterical.
So there's that balance. But I think sometimes the men need to just be willing to say when they should, they don't. So it's sometime we do need
well,
to.
Well, you know, there is a thing called courage. There's yeah. also a thing called courage.
In Hawaii, we call it uncling them. We're going to correct you because we love you.
Sure.
But we can't just let lawlessness run.
Yep, but you need to have that kind of charism. You have to have that gift, that personality, and not everybody does.
Some people need to have more of it, though. Some people have it and won't act.
I don't argue with you.
Right at me when you say that. I feel like you're, that's the Bear Wozniak adventure. Bear, thank you very much. Our guest has been Dr. David Anders. We're going to continue take two with Debbie and Jerry. That very same Debbie and Jerry will be with us for the next hour. Dr. Anders, I absolutely love your work. Your show is my favorite thing on the radio, and thanks for doing this hour with
us. Thanks so much, Simon. My pleasure.
And we'll see you out in California before too long.
Absolutely. All right, we'll coming next month.
Oh, very good. Very good. All right, right back with more coming to you live from Phoenix, Arizona, where we are at the EWTN National Radio Conference. Jerry and Debbie standing right over there up next.